We discovered this tool, which we'd love everybody on Earth to learn. And we call it the Ha-Hum move, because people get lost in the ha.
Ha.
I know what yes. you've done. Ha. I know what
no,
you did. You know,
no,
you're the reason I'm unhappy. And we started going, how am I contributing to this? Instead of ha, it's your fault.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for your career and your life. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. Our guests today are two, Katie and Gay Hendricks, founders of the Hendricks Institute. They are both prominent psychologists in the U.S. They have been together for over 40 years. They've co-written, produced, somehow published over 40 books. And they have trained coaches all around the world. They have appeared on Oprah. And today, listener, their career peaks by appearing on our podcast. Thank you for joining us, Katie and Gay.
This is it. We cannot go further now.
I mean, how good can it get, really? I mean,
we were looking for this next place to go after Oprah. And it looks like we landed.
We're all living in the fast lane on this podcast. I'm here to tell you. Now, Gay, I know that you were a professor of counseling psychology at Colorado University for 21 years. And Catherine, I know that your doctorate is in transpersonal psychology. And somehow that all translates into the Hendricks Institute. So tell me more about that.
Yes. Well, I'm Kathleen, but everybody calls me Katie.
Katie.
So when we met each other, we found we were both very interested in how we could use the natural resources of our body, breathing and movement, to assist our evolution, because everybody was just talking and was pretty head-centric. And there's not a lot of evolution that can happen just by talking about it. But we found when we added breathing and movement and ways of engaging your whole body learning, that people not only learned a lot, but they were able to share what they learned and were able to coach people much more effectively than simply talking to them.
We met actually a little over 40 years ago. As a matter of fact, in October, we're just preparing for our 40th wedding anniversary. So if you happen to be in the neighborhood, but we got together in around 1980, and I was very interested. I discovered the power of body-centered tools like breathing and helping people learn to work with their emotions. And then I saw what Katie was doing in the whole field of movement therapy. She was one of the first certified dance and movement therapists in the United States. And I saw her, she would be able to work with a problem, just a regular, ordinary problem that somebody came in with, or a relationship issue between two people. And she would do this movement stuff with them, and it looked like magic because it worked so quickly. And so we kind of put our heads together there and have been working together ever since. And we've written about a dozen books together and been all over the world and created a great relationship at the same time.
And what we do at the Hendricks Institute is to provide resources for people to enhance their relationships, whether it's corporate or romantic, personal or friendship. And also we teach seminars where we have taught thousands of coaches how to use our techniques, and they can integrate our techniques into whatever they're doing so that it enhances their ability to reach their goals, to be able to create new solutions from corporate to personal kinds of coaching. So that's one of the main things that we do through the Hendricks Institute.
From boardroom to bedroom, I read that somewhere.
Yes.
That's the topics that you
I believe we've said that. Yes.
Well, yeah, because we found it exactly the same principles that transform organizations are useful in the war between the sheets.
Well, speaking of books, let me tell you how this all came about. About 20 years ago, a girlfriend of mine gave me a book called Conscious Living. Now, Katie, why a woman would give me a book about enhancing consciousness, I don't know. I don't know. Beyond me. So, but I read this. And like you, Gay, I read a lot of books. I mean, I read well over 100 books a year. And now you spend some, pass them along, give them to friends, and don't retain them. Except that one. Conscious Living is my first introduction to the work of you both. And I have read it, reread it. I annotate it, as I often do. I have taken notes on script and travel around with those notes, refer to them routinely throughout the throughout over the years. And that's, and I need to say once again, thank you, Gina, for giving me that book, because I know she's going to watch this podcast.
Is Gina still in your life?
She is. She is. We're still friends. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Great.
Married to other people, but yes. And I got to wondering, why do I hang on to this book? And there was a couple of reasons. One, it's amusing. I want you to know, Gay, I think I pretty much liberated all your jokes in there for my own purposes. And secondly, it's accessible. I mean, you're dealing with some pretty heavy psychological concepts. And I'm speaking as a person who used to work in psychiatry, but really it's just so bloody useful. It's just a good book to have to refer to. And so I want to mention that book, Conscious Loving. I want to mention it in particular. Now, that's just one of the 40. Your latest book, I believe, is called The Genius Zone. Do you happen to have a copy of that there with you?
As a matter of fact,
what are the chances?
I'm surrounded. One day last week, I found 4 gigantic boxes of books here, and I've been signing my way through them. So yes, I happen to have many copies of The Genius Zone here. The Genius Zone is a follow-up to my other book, The Big Leap, that came out about 12 years ago. And The Big Leap is widely used in coaching programs and all sorts of programs. I was just giving a talk an hour ago to Benjamin Hardy's group. He's got a group of several thousand people that meet, and they're using The Big Leap and The Genius Zone as their curriculum for the next 6 months. And so I was kind of leading off the charge there in giving them a talk. And so what these books are about how to access and express your unique genius. And I have found in working with people over the years that most of us don't realize how much of a genius we actually are. Mm-hmm. And so we've provided a number of tools in the 2 books to access your genius and to get it on the line, and then also how to stay in what I call your genius zone. Your genius zone is when you're doing what you most love to do, and it's also you're doing it in such a way that it makes the biggest contribution to the world around you, or to your family, or people in your business. And so if you get those 2 things working together, what you love to do and what makes your biggest contribution, that's what I call your genius zone. And the book is basically about how to get there and how to stabilize there, so you're living there all the time.
The genius zone. The theme that I believe I detect in the work of you both and in the Hendricks Institute is how to help people get unstuck from where they are to where they want to be. So that takes us to our first lesson. Lesson number 1, knowing how to commit and recommit is the central skill in relationship and reaching your goals and in resolving issues.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And what people don't realize is that committing is an action. It's not a thing. That when I commit, I'm actually gathering myself and taking myself in a chosen direction. So a lot of people don't really get where they're going because they haven't decided where they're going. And so the first thing is, am I going to get into the game? Am I going to take my whole self toward what I want? Mm-hmm. But a lot of people think that's it. Once I've committed, that should be it. You know, it's like once I've bought the product, you know, it should just start automatically producing for me. So the second skill is that when we fall off track, we forget, we mess up, instead of beating ourselves up or blaming somebody else for it, we simply recommit. Go, oh, I forgot. Oh, I broke an agreement. Oh, I completely don't understand where I'm going. I'm going to reconfigure and recommit. And when you learn how to recommit, it's actually an even more important skill than committing.
Because one thing we teach people to think of their personal growth as their goals, as being like the automatic pilot on an airplane, that you're going to set it for a certain goal, but you've got to expect that you're going to drift from time to time. And so we put a special emphasis on teaching people how to recommit when they've kind of slipped off the direction they want to go in. Because if you think of an automatic pilot, let's say you're in Brazil and you want to get to New York, the pilot sets the thing for New York, but it doesn't get there in a completely linear fashion. It gets there by drifting and shifting. It drifts off center, and then a little voice in there says, hey, we're drifting off to the right, let's correct toward the center. And oh, we're drifting off to the left. So all of this is programmed in so that it's in a constant state of learning and being willing to recommit after it slipped off its original commitment. And it's a better way to look at the world too, because that means that the automatic pilot gets from Brazil to New York by being wrong most of the time. And that's the way we are. You know, it's not so much that you set your goal, that's important, but what to do when you drift off of it, whether you turn that into a big destructive drama, or do you simply recommit and get back to the business at hand? I remember when I was taking my daughter, when she was 6 years old, she wanted to go on a horse riding lesson for her birthday. She'd never ridden a horse before. And so I took her out to the place, and there was a lovely woman who was the trainer. And I remember Amanda got up on the horse and they took off and they went about 20 feet before Amanda fell off. And I, of course, I was watching from behind the fence and I'm jumping up and down and freaking out. But the trainer, she just looked and made sure Amanda was okay, but she put her right back up the horse and they took off again. This time she made it about 30 seconds. She fell off again. I freaked out. And so they kept going around. And finally, and to this day, Amanda can jump on a horse here 40 years later and take off in a gallop because she's got it down in her bones. Mm-hmm. But I remember that first stage of having to get back on the horse and get back on the horse. And it really taught me an important lesson about the value of recommitment.
And the other thing you notice about an airplane is that up there in the cockpit, if you were listening in, when things go off course, they're not yelling at each other, which is what often happens with humans, is that when you go off course, you look for who's to blame rather than, oh, how did I help create this? And then you simply recommit to what you're wanting to do. And you take an action in that direction rather than an action toward hassling each other. And so then you learn over time to navigate the speed bumps, which are inevitable. And any of us who don't know that, we've had a big lesson in that in the last year and a half or 2 years.
Well, and that takes us to lesson number two about creating no blame zones. Knowing how to create within your close relationships these no blame zones as a framework, because that's where creativity and harmony occur.
Yes.
Yes, very important point because, well, first of all, I just want to clarify, we're talking about creating your relationship as a no blame zone.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that what we're teaching people is how to have relationships that do not have blame and criticism embedded in them.
In most relationships, their fuel is adrenaline and conflict. So when you're experiencing adrenaline, like whose fault is it? You get that burst of energy, but it's very short-lived and it creates distance and separation between you. But most people think that's inevitable in relationship. And what we found is that when you're not blaming, it gives room for creativity, for appreciation, for co-creativity to emerge, which cannot happen in a blaming relationship. So we made a decision, long time ago.
It was a year or so into our relationship, yeah. Early on, bless their hearts, very dear people, but they bickered at each other constantly. And they came to visit us in Colorado right after we'd gotten together. And we spent the whole weekend listening to them bicker. And after they left, we got together and he said, you know what? We've gotten into the habit of bickering with each other. We're perpetuating that style in our relationship.
Particularly through criticizing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to eliminate blame and criticism from our relationship. And we made a commitment to doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what do you talk about? I don't understand. What's that?
Exactly. That's what people would say. Well, we would talk about what we're discovering. We put actually a lot of attention into shifting from criticizing into appreciating, because people don't realize that appreciating is one of the most valuable moves that you can make in your relationship. Because when you appreciate, you're creating an emotional reservoir of connection that you can draw on. And also thriving relationships have at least a 5-to-1 ratio of appreciations to criticisms. So when we would find ourselves criticizing this, and this applies to the first rule, instead of whose fault was that, we go, oh, okay, we're recommitting mm-hmm. to stopping criticizing. And,
And yeah, we discovered this tool, mm-hmm. which we'd love everybody on earth to learn. And we call it the ha hum move, because people get lost in the ha.
Ha.
I know what you've done. I know what you did. You know, you're the reason I'm unhappy. And we started going, how am I contributing to this? Instead of ha, it's your fault.
And that move, shifts you from critical brain into wonder brain. And it also opens up the possibility of seeing yourself and your partner free of fear, because criticism and blame drive fear. That drives adrenaline. That keeps us in a state of anticipating what's going to go wrong, instead of opening up to enjoying each other, being able to notice what's wanting to happen rather than always having it be a fight and a conflict and who's going to be in control.
I read somewhere that most relationship arguments are a race to occupy the role of victim. Am I quoting?
You might have heard that somewhere.
I knew it was in that book, Conscious Living. I knew it.
It's true too, because if you look at any relationship argument that persists for a while, you'll see that both people are entrenched in the victim position, and they're busily making the other person the persecutor or the villain.
Oh, poor me. Look what you did.
Yeah, but the other person, you know, if you blame another person, the other person doesn't usually go along with it.
And they just not cheerfully say, oh, yeah, I see.
Oh, yeah, I am the reason you're unhappy. Yeah, it never had occurred to me that I was causing.
Why didn't I think of that? It's so obvious now that you mention it.
But interestingly enough, Duff, the only way really to get out of blame is by taking healthy personal responsibility, not blaming yourself, not saying, oh, why did I do this? Or why am I? But it's, why would I create an argument at this particular time about that? That takes responsibility. It's a wonder move. And if one thing the Hendricks Institute teaches, it's the art of wonder. Because if you can cultivate wonder in yourself, you've got a direct access to the creative energy of the universe. Einstein, I'm just pointing over here because you can't see it, but I have an autographed picture of Einstein that Katie gave me 1 year. It's one of my treasured possessions. Einstein wondered about a particular issue in physics every day, he said, for 27 years. That's amazing. That's a Guinness Book of World Record of wondering. But you know, if you look at pictures of it, you know, he looks like he's living pretty well inside there. He doesn't look like he's unhappy. And so I think the gift of wonder is one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself, because it's the antidote to fear. If you're afraid about something, what better thing to do than to turn it into wonder? I wonder how I created myself in this situation, and how can I create it so I'm not in this situation? So that's a great use of our emotions, is to trip us right away into wonder.
One of the great things about your work, and I'm speaking about this personally, is that you give us ways out. You show us ways out so that we don't have to keep repeating mindlessly. And as you know, if you worked in psychology and psychiatry, there's so many patterns of human behavior, some positive, some negative, some profitable, some very much not. And you use the word shift and move. And I know that a lot of your work is exactly that, showing somebody how to change, reposition themselves physically, emotionally, mentally, psychology. And you are so right. There is such a huge body of evidence to support this. And so that's one reason why I really appreciate the work that you folks do. Let me proceed to lesson number three. Authenticity is sexy, which just tells me I need to tap the depths of authenticity, because I missed that one. So please do tell.
When you are transparent with people, they don't get sexually aroused.
I've not noticed it, but I will try with renewed vigor now that I know that authenticity is sexy.
Okay, well, let's think about that.
One of the most exciting things that I discovered, and I first discovered with you, because I would notice that when you were speaking, I could see you creating from what you were experiencing, that there was this direct line from what you were experiencing to what came out your mouth. And of course, I found it incredibly sexy. And I wondered, how is he doing that? Because he wasn't repeating, you know, the sense of repeating something that somebody had told him. he was revealing himself with everything that he said. And in all of the, I've trained thousands of coaches, and in one of the things that we do with people is teach them how to access what am I actually experiencing and how can I communicate that in a way that other people can receive it, but it also matches what I'm experiencing. And when people do that, it's electric. Everybody in the room can see it, because I mean, and it doesn't have to be nice or gentle. It can be roaring or, you know, somebody really expressing something very deep, but it's congruent. Mm-hmm. And that alignment, you know, it's like a flower blooming in its own uniqueness. And when people express their uniqueness, it's very exciting. It's probably the most inspiring thing that I have seen in working with people, because most people are trying to fit in. They're trying to say something that they're going to get approval and avoid disapproval, and they're have people like them and not be shunned or not be bullied. And that kind of reacting contracts people, so they can't really find their own originality. But when they commit to being authentic, then they start authoring themselves, and surprising things and really fun kinds of things can occur. Any one of our students could share with you probably 10 stories of how they were blown out by somebody else's authenticity or by watching our authenticity with each other.
Yes, as a matter of fact, we got here through a moment of authenticity.
That's right.
In our first conversation with each other. I had just had a big download the month before of how I messed up relationships. And one of them was not being honest, not being transparent. I wasn't good at talking about my feelings. And I don't know how many women had told me, gosh, you never say anything, you know, authentic in there, but I couldn't figure out what they were getting at, you know. But then finally I realized, oh, my job is to simply say what's going on. Like if I'm scared, to say I'm scared, or if I'm angry, I say I'm angry, or if I'm sad, I say I'm sad. It's that simple a lot of times, of just finding out what's true and just saying it. And so I figured out transparency. Okay, I want a transparent relationship. Number two, I was really sick of that whole blame thing. And I just caught on to the power of taking responsibility instead of blame. So I want a relationship where both people can do that. And the third thing, I decided I want a relationship where both people are equally committed to their creativity, because I'd been in relationships where I always write every day. And so I'd mm-hmm. disappear into a room for 2 or 3 hours. And if that's not okay with the person I was with, they would sometimes hassle me about that. And so anyway, this had just happened. So my first conversation with Katie, I wanted to ask her out for coffee because I thought she was the most beautiful human being I've ever seen.
I got to tell you, the very first thing that he said to me, because I went up at a break to ask a question, and the very first thing he said to me was, I'm very attracted to you.
I've been watching her across the room. I tell you, that is the correct form for a female human being to be in.
And, so that was the first thing that he said to me, followed by.
I said, you know, I don't know if this is going to be our first conversation of the rest of our lives or the last conversation of the rest of our lives, but I would like to ask you out for a cup of coffee. But I want you to know I'm only interested in relationships where both people are honest and transparent, and both people take responsibility rather than blaming each other, and both people are equally committed to their creative path. So on those terms, would you like to have coffee with me?
That's one hell of a pickup line, I got to tell you.
But what I came back was, how about lunch?
Yeah.
So I upped the ante on me.
And so we've been together ever since. That was a long lunch, a 40-year lunch now. And I married her as soon as I could just pin her down. And so we've been together now more than 40 years. So the important thing we're getting at here, though, is that those three things are really crucial to relationship, because we've had hundreds, if not thousands now, of couples in here or in our seminars that were blocked because one or the other of them was sitting on an untold truth. And it could be a big truth, like one I'm remembering where a woman said, I had a one-nighter with your best friend 7 years ago. You know, that makes for an exciting next 10 minutes or so of conversation. But I've also had people in here that we're just afraid to say the simplest things, like, I was really scared about that, or I don't like doing that, but I couldn't bring myself to tell you. You know, something that's a simple truth. That oftentimes is more common than the I had sex with your best friend kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not the thing. It's the act of expressing. And what it took us a long time to learn is that that act of expressing opens up aliveness, opens up connections, knowing yourself, feeling located, presencing yourself, being able to connect with others. And it starts with that decision to share what's actually going on. And the purpose of all of our work is to reveal essence, who you really are. And who you really are is unique. And so part of the journey of relationship is the continuous discovery of how each of you are becoming. Because you're learning different things, you're learning with other people, you're bringing that back to your relationship. You have different rhythms of wanting to be close and wanting to be separate. And those are all things that you can simply communicate about rather than thinking, no, is he going to like it? Is she going to get mad at me? You know, are they going to leave me if I say that? Which is how part of how we control relationships rather than allowing them to flower and really make a contribution in the world.
Wow, I love to hear you talk.
Thank you.
I don't get to be interviewed very often with Katie, only every week or two, but I really, I always say Katie's voice is better than any Mozart symphony I've ever heard. So the opportunity to sit next to her for an hour is really quite a treat.
Well, what I've learned is that Katie hung out with Einstein and that Gay became a roaring sex machine through authenticity. So those are...
Great, let's keep, you've been really keeping up. Thank
and we're only on lesson three.
Well, let's keep going and see what happens. I wonder what's going to come next. Okay, lesson number four. This sounds like you, Katie. Use body intelligence. Whole body learning is a way to connect.
Yes, because most people think that they basically are ahead. They're just ahead. In fact, one of the quotes that's one of my favorites is Thomas Edison said that the only good use of the body is as a vehicle to carry the head from place to place. And I think a lot of people, I remember also a couple who came in and the man said, if you could just get her to stop feeling, you know, if she could just stop feeling and if she could get dinner at 6 o'clock, I'd be happy. So a lot of...
And we said, you got to set yourself bigger goals for your life. And, just those two things.
So when we start making the move from here to here, with particularly the question of, well, how are you experiencing that in your body? So if people come in and they're stuck, they think it's about something rather than it's actually about being stuck. And if you look at and feel into, oh, I'm stuck, I'm not breathing. Oh, and when I breathe, then some sadness comes up. Oh, I'm really sad. I felt disconnected with you last week and I didn't tell you about it. And then what's actually going on starts to emerge. And when people get into their bodies and they're breathing and they're moving, then you get to really see what the patterns are in communication. Rather than when people are talking, they can conceal that for years and years. So one of the patterns that I notice a lot in relationship, because relationship is about getting close and getting separate, the urge to merge and the urge to individuate. But very often when one person wants to get close, if the other person doesn't know how to communicate, they'll either create an argument in order to get separate, or they'll run away. Or when they want to get close and the other person doesn't. And so you have this kind of pinball machine going on rather than people going, oh, I noticed that I tensed up when you said that. And that kind of communication has a great power to open up presence. And then you can connect with another person and then you can collaborate in a new way.
One of the things Katie said I wanted to highlight is that we say the longest journey any human being ever makes is 12 inches from their head down to their heart. And the act of integrating the power of the mind with our emotions and who we are deep inside, the space that we all are, Well, those kinds of things get obscured a lot of times because people kind of duke it out on the mental level and don't ever get down to resolve the real emotional stuff that's underneath most arguments. Like, for example, we have something on our charitable foundation website called the Fear Melters that people can access freely. And they are four different ways of dealing with fear. So that what we discovered is that fear is underneath a lot of problems in relationships, in the bedroom, in the boardroom, in the living room, that one or both people get scared about something and then communicate out of that fear. And oftentimes what happens is
visual aids now.
By the way, I don't know, most people are probably accessing this on audio, aren't they?
Both. There's two channels, audio and YouTube. And the YouTube channel is surprisingly popular, so that's fine. Please continue.
Okay, good. Great. So if you're not at a place where you can watch this, the Fear Melters is, there are four expressions of fear: fight, flee, freeze, and faint. And all mammals go through that, and other species probably do. But most people don't realize that even their anger comes out of fear. It's a response to fear.
It's a fight response.
It's a fight response.
Not really anger. And so the moves here, oozing, sumo, wiggling, and love scoops, are very simple movements that move you from fear to presence so that you can actually think. Because when you're in fear, other people become the enemy. And when you're in fear, you can't use your whole brain. You're only using the reptilian part of your brain. So Fear Melters can shift you into presence in 2 minutes. And so we want everybody to know how to do Fear Melters so that they can move from the juice of adrenaline and fear to the juice of presence and creativity.
And let me clarify, when you say the reptilian part of the brain, that is the oldest part of the human brain and our species. It's small. It's the part that's kept our species alive. So I always like to take a brief moment to appreciate it. And because it sends out such powerful signals, the rest of the brain has evolved basically to damp down the signals sometimes because that fear response is so overwhelmingly powerful. Doesn't mean you're not saying we're reptiles, in other words.
No. Although we are reptiles.
Well, there's an old saying that you learn in therapy training that they say, when a person comes in, you're dealing with a human being, a horse, and a crocodile, because we have three levels of our brain. The limbic system is all about emotion. You know, a grapefruit, most people have seen a grapefruit. A grapefruit is approximately the same size as a brain, a human brain. And it's arranged in a way like the thinking part, our cortex, the latest thing that has evolved, is about the size of the rind of the grapefruit compared to the juicy stuff, which is about the size of the limbic part of the brain. So we need to make sure in life that we're getting our smart cortex that's aligned now with our old emotional wiring, because our emotions have been around for a lot longer than our thinking brain, and especially those real old emotions like fear and survival and things like that. So we need to integrate our minds and our bodies and our emotions so that we can have access to the largest possible canvas on which to paint the magnificent story of our lives.
Well, it takes us to lesson number 5, conscious listening creates magic. Now, how does conscious listening differ from just normal, plain, vanilla flavored listening?
Let's do some unconscious listening.
Let me start.
There you go. tell me you're tired several times.
I'm tired.
Well, why don't you just kind of pep it up a little bit? You know, here's an affirmation for you. Just say, I am.
Here's a punch for you. So I'll do it again. So, I've been feeling tired today.
Huh. What's wrong with you? What the hell's wrong with you?
So when that would be. Stop being tired all the time.
Yeah. When are you going to think of somebody besides yourself?
Go on. Yes.
You're not paying us enough to go on.
Really, conscious listening, there are three aspects of conscious listening that we teach people. One is, and you'd think, well, it's so simple. Why doesn't everybody do that? Which is turning toward.
Just actually developing a listening posture.
Yes.
Open posture of listening.
Yeah. So turning toward and turning toward, we've had people turn toward like this. So turn toward and then fold up. So turning toward and opening your posture and breathing. So those three things really set the stage for you being able to actually receive, give and receive information. Because truly most people are rehearsing what they're going to say. Mm-hmm. They're rebutting or they're in there judging you or judging themselves. So conscious listening is, I think, such a key to having a successful life. I think all really conscious people, evolved people, know how to listen and give great attention to their listening. So they're listening for accuracy.
Yeah, so let's do I'm tired
again. Yeah, okay. Oh, I've been feeling tired today.
Huh. And where are you feeling that in your body?
Oh, I notice I've got sort of cords that have sort of come up in my shoulders.
Mm. So that sounds like your neck is tense.
Yeah, my neck has been feeling tense.
And has that been something that's been going on all day, or did some particular thing trigger it?
Oh, no, it was when I got that phone call. That phone call I was telling you about, where I can just feel it right now. I just went,
Yeah, so notice that what I was doing there was just expressing interest and chaining off whatever she was saying. I wasn't trying to fix her. Mm-hmm, and that was one of my biggest listening filters when I got into relationship. Katie would tell me something and I thought it was my job to fix it. And so she would literally say, I'm tired. And I'd say, well, why don't you breathe a little bit? Or, you know, let's go out for a brisk walk. So I thought it was my job to solve her problem. Mm-hmm. And boy, did I get a lot from learning that she didn't want me to solve her problem. She wanted me to just listen and appreciate and, you know, mm-hmm. be with her in that. She's very capable of solving her own problems, but what she needed was just somebody to pay attention and listen.
Boy, one thing that I've really seen during the pandemic is the power of combined presence. So we can all, even though we can't be together physically, many of us, we can be together in our listening. And I can turn toward you, even if we're not in the same place, and open up my body and breathing, and then I'm adding my energy to yours. I'm not adding content, but I'm adding presence. And in that collaboration is really where discovery gets to happen. And also the deep sense of being connected to, because I think that what most of us are suffering from right now is not feeling connected. And that, of course, is the basis of addiction. And when people are able to feel received, that their presence makes a difference, that they are heard, the whole physiology settles down. There's this sense of possibility that opens up and a sense of, oh, I have value. So I think the great contribution of conscious listening is it demonstrates value to whoever you're listening to.
Another way to look at that too is that almost everybody has listening shields or listening filters where you're listening for criticism, you're listening to find fault, or you're listening to argue with the person. So what we're after is a much more open-hearted kind of listening where you really do your best to not only hear what's going on, but also absorb it and feel. Because oftentimes if you can share feelings with another person in the sense of trying them on for yourself, it builds a real bond that can really last forever.
Oh, and I wanted to mention that on our charitable website, which is called Foundation for Conscious Living, we have many videos that show people how to gain these skills. So if they can't come to a seminar, we have free videos and we have a whole body listening map that people can download and has a little journey and different things that you can learn. So if people want to dive into more of the skills, we have them either on Hendrix.com or Foundation for Conscious Living, because we want everybody to have access to these.
Excellent. Let me proceed, because lesson number 6, I say to the listener, to the viewer, if you take away nothing today, take away this next one. Lesson number 6, making and keeping agreements impeccably is how you create ease and flow in your life. it really is just that simple in my experience. And I think I must have learned this from you folks, one of your books, but I've been preaching this for a decade plus now.
Yes, it is. When you make an agreement, you're actually creating a blueprint. You're like setting out, like if you're building a house, you first have a blueprint. But when you create an agreement, you are actually making an energetic blueprint. And when you step into that, you like plug in, you complete the circuit on that blueprint. But when you don't keep your agreements, you say you're going to do something and you don't do it, you throw a log jam into your ability to actually generate plans to do what you say you're going to do. You become much less effective. I'm remembering that there are people whom I've said, you know, who've said like, I'm going to call you at one, and they do. So me, that goes, okay, this is a person with whom I can co-create. But someone who says, I'm going to call you at one, and then they don't call at one. And then when I finally get a hold, they say, oh gosh, I forgot.
Yeah, broken agreements cause a lot of drama in relationships, mm-hmm. and not just romantic relationships or family, but also if you look in business relationships, you'll see how much attention has to be put into repairing broken agreements. And so one of the things we teach, in fact, we have a whole deck of cards we give people called the impeccability deck about how to really make and keep your agreements, or if you cannot keep an agreement, how to change it consciously, because mm-hmm. sometimes that happens. But what we found is that oftentimes people have a pattern of not keeping agreements. A pattern of being late all the time, or a pattern of not showing up where they're supposed to show up, or not getting the project done mm-hmm. by the time they said they were going to do it at 5 o'clock this afternoon. So picking up the slack eats up a lot of energy that could be going into creative fulfillment of the ideas that you're
right. And it also creates a lot of disagreement and a lot of disconnection, because if I'm depending on you, if you're handing off something to me and it doesn't happen, it affects my life and then all the people I'm handing it off to. And we think of that in business, but it's really true in each part of our life. If someone is going to be delivering something that makes a difference, or even just an agreement that you're going to talk over something or you're going to do something together, when agreements don't work, well, you can kind of see in our country, you can see what's happened in the last 5 years in the area of agreements. Mm-hmm. People not doing what they said they were going to do, doing the opposite of what they said they were going to do. So we're in the middle of needing to recreate our whole relationship with each other, because hardly anybody's keeping agreements until, you know, this last 6 months.
I would say that in business, in my 30-year career as an executive search consultant and executive coach, plus running psychotherapy groups in psychiatric hospitals, if you want to do well in your relationships, if you want to do well in business, if you want to do well in your career, if you want to be promoted, if you want to have just a decent life, just keep your damn agreements. It really is just that simple. That's a good point, Gay. I hadn't thought about, there is a very high cost in business to having to repair broken agreements. The phrase in business is that a brand is a promise. You go to McDonald's, you have certain expectations. You buy this brand of product, you have certain expectations. And they spend a lot of money, a lot of time trying to create those, instill those expectations in you. And they're not supposed to let you down, because that's what you're paying for. Literally, that's what you're paying for.
Literally, yes. Yeah. Mm. And the other thing I wanted to just give a little bit of attention to is that when people don't keep an agreement, or they're anticipating not keeping an agreement, people don't know how to change agreements that are not mm-hmm. working. And so that's mm-hmm. one of the skills that we teach people, is that if you're not able to keep an agreement, change it before the due date, you know, so that you don't say, oh, I was going to call you about that and say I couldn't do it. So just knowing this doesn't work for me, I'm going to need to change this agreement. And you can find out if that works for the other people. And that then it keeps you again in connection with yourself and with the other person. And you're not building up resentments and withholds.
It's much easier these days with technology too. Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, my granddad was visiting up in Missouri, and he was going to come down on the train. And we went to the train station two or three days in a row when the train came, because we really didn't know which one he was going to be on. And because there wasn't anything like you call up and say, hey, I'm coming on the 2 o'clock train. But now, you know, like all the time, like today I knew I was going to be late for my trainer that I work out with 3 days a week. And he wouldn't care if I was late, but it matters to me. So I texted it, I'm going to be about 5 minutes late. And so that kind of thing, to make sure you, if you can't keep an agreement, to communicate about it in a way that doesn't inconvenience the other person. Because, you know, like he knew I was going to be 5 minutes late, so he ran up to the coffee shop and got a cup of coffee. And so it gave him time to do that, that he wouldn't have done if he hadn't known when I was coming. So yeah, keeping agreements. If you want to keep your life elegantly smooth and free of drama, that's a good one to do.
All right, well, let us proceed to lesson number 7. The one central problem in life is the upper limit problem. Is that scary enough? Yes. I have no idea what that means, by the way, so I'm hoping you'll enlighten me, but it just sounds really...
Oh, yes, we will.
Well, good. I have a tiny understanding of what that means, so I'll do my best. By the way, if you haven't read The Big Leap, folks, The Big Leap is about two big things. One, it's about how to find your genius zone, and also it's about how to overcome your upper limit problem. The new book, The Genius Zone, is about how to live in the genius zone all the time. So the reason The Big Leap has a goldfish on the cover diving into this new bowl is it usually takes a big leap to get us into our genius. But the upper limit problem is the one problem, because wherever you find yourself getting stuck, you will find that that very thing, if you open to it correctly, is an invitation to your genius. So for example, if I get stuck on something, that some problem we're having between me and Katie, the moment I can, you know, become transparent about it and communicate about it in a way that takes 100% responsibility for it, suddenly this flow awakens. Mm. And I've seen it in boardrooms, and I've seen it 1,000 times in the office here, that people overcome whatever upper limit they are, and they move immediately into that beautiful flow state that I'm calling genius. And so the direct effect of overcoming an upper limit problem is that it gives you a direct door into the creative essence of yourself and the universe. So the reason we say it's the only problem is just about anywhere you look, in your relationships or with your kids or in your business or whatever, you'll see that people come up against the upper limit problem and get stuck because of some limiting belief they have. And then if things work well, they move through that and go into a new level. They take their life to the next level, or take their work to the next level.
So in our understanding of the upper limit, what we call the upper limit is that we each have a thermostat setting for how good we can feel, mm-hmm. and how much exchange of friendship or relationship we can enjoy. And that thermostat, we didn't set it. It got set by our family. It got set by the culture. In every culture that we've ever been in, you're from Australia, you know about the tall poppy syndrome. So mm-hmm. people are all taught, don't be a tall poppy, because guess what happens to the tall poppy? It gets cut off. And so, you know, like I heard a lot, you know, don't be so full of yourself, you know, who do you think you are? And there are all kinds of messages that the culture has, and it's really intended to keep us safe. I think the upper limit is really, it's a survival program that all of us have. And so the purpose of our work is to enjoy more and more giving and receiving love every day, to expanding our capacity for enjoying love, success, and abundance every day. And that's really that's why we call it the only problem, because you can turn in all of your current problems for this one. Am I willing to expand my capacity every day for giving and receiving more love and enjoying love, abundance, and success?
And so the upper limit problem is, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's the limiting beliefs we have, and it's a constellation, how much joy or success or whatever we permit ourselves.
Yes.
Yes.
Before we punish ourselves or limit ourselves or bring ourselves back down. Yeah. So make a lot of money and then lose the money. There, you know, if you look anywhere in life, you'll see that people will come up against, oh, I can't possibly do that. And they'll bring themselves back to a more familiar level.
A good example of that is I did a big study of lottery winners when I was writing The Big Leap. And an astonishingly large percentage of people that win a lottery are within a year or so back down to where they were below, or sometimes worse off than where they were below. And so, you know, that's a very vivid example of the upper limit. In real life, most people won't encounter anything quite that dramatic, but what they notice is just things will be going along for a while and then an argument will ensue, or they'll be feeling good for a while, then they'll get a cold, or they'll have good money issues for a while and then they'll run into a wall there. So it's our own little unique method of self-sabotage, and it's all grounded in fear. So the thing to do is start looking underneath that and unpacking those fears that drive it.
Well, and that takes us directly to lesson number 8, master the shift from fear to presence.
Yes.
Yes. And that's what we were talking about with you earlier, particularly through fear melters. But in any way, because when you're in fear, when any of us are in fear, we contract. So we're not breathing as much, we're not moving freely. And so just even making any kind of spontaneous movement, opening your breathing, those will assist you to be able to explore what's underneath your fear rather than being just stopped by your fear. And when people are in fear, they just recycle survival mechanisms. And you kind of think, well, why is that person doing that crazy thing again that they always do? It's because they're not thinking. So the moving from fear to presence, because people always say, all you need to do is move from fear to love. You know, just, you know, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself. And as if you could just muscle your way out of fear. But we found that if you use just gentle body intelligence moves, you can presence yourself. And when I'm present, I'm able to respond. And we really think of responsibility as being able to respond, not reacting. When we're in fear, we're simply reacting in the ways that we learned in the fear patterns that we were describing. So when you move to presence, then the world becomes available again.
One of the things we say here is fear is excitement without the breath. In other words, when you remember to breathe, suddenly fear turns into excitement. If you're clutched up and holding your breath, fear gets to be very compelling. Sophocles said, when we're scared, everything rustles. You know, if you're contracted in fear, everything looks scary out there. And sometimes actually only takes about three good breaths to begin to melt down the stress chemistry in your body.
And this is the thrust of it. When you make the move, the shift from fear to presence, your ability to respond, your responsibility is regained or enlarged or activated because it's probably shut off in fear. And that's the power of this shift.
Yes, because then you can make a new choice. Because what makes people leave their relationships, and you know, whether it's romantic or at work, is just the same old of conflict and power struggles, and that are all run by fear. And then when you're in fear, adrenaline really runs you. But adrenaline, since it has a short half-life, has to be accentuated. So you get more adrenaline, you get more drama, you get more. And we've seen that play out in our country vividly over the last 5 years, the acceleration of adrenaline, the acceleration of drama, because people are reacting and in from fear rather than being in presence.
Well, what I love about your work is that you're giving us an out. Gay, I know a lot of your work or both of your work is a lot on breathing consciously and as a counteraction, because you don't negate fear. I mean, it's either there, it's not. And you don't get a choice. It's either there, it's not. But being able to cope with it and to diffuse it and to employ it to your benefit. Now that's very valuable.
It really is, because you got to realize too that emotions are energy. And then we turn them into a meaning in our head. You know, it's a stirring energy in your belly, or it's a stirring energy in your back. So they're all energetic issues, the emotions are. And there's a great bit of a poem I love from Walt Whitman, where he says, I am large and contain multitudes. And what we're kind of teaching is how to experience that big spacious mm-hmm. self in which you have some fears, anger, sadnesses, experiences, but it's the vast spaciousness of yourself that's your true identity.
And with that, we'll proceed to lesson number 9. Genius emerges in the space of appreciation. In fact, relationships flourish with liberal appreciation.
Yes, we've always practiced a lot of appreciation of each other, but then we came across that little study from John Gottman's people up in the University of Washington, where they found that thriving relationships have a 5-to-1 ratio of appreciations or positive comments to negative comments. And relationships that are going out of business, heading toward divorce, have about a 1-to-1. For every positive thing that's said, there's a negative thing that's said on the average. And so we started thinking, okay, let's take that seriously. Let's give each of ourselves at least 5 appreciations mm-hmm. today. And then we started building up from there. But that's a good place to start. Just think of 5 things that just blow you away about your partner mm-hmm. and communicate those to her. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate Katie so much during the day. Last night, I remember we had a wonderful conversation. We were just lying there reading, and suddenly I felt this incredible wave of appreciation for you. And I just shared it with her, and it led to the most wonderful connection for a while. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's the best theater on earth, ourselves are, and our feelings.
it's really true.
Better than any television series.
And also, appreciation allows you to create a new story. Instead of the story of whose fault it is and who gets to be in control, it's a story of discovery. Because, see, we've been together over 42 years now. And the experience that we had last night was a new kind of energetic expansion and feeling so deeply connected with each other. It was incredibly nourishing. Our 2 cats had to come and see what was going on. they could feel it. And so then we become generators of creativity, of aliveness, of connection for others as well as ourselves. And I'll tell you, when people are appreciated, what you're pointing out to them is something that they may think, oh, well, doesn't everybody do that? You know, like an ability to really be deeply present with others, or an ability to notice the nuances. And if you appreciate that about something, they go, oh, it doesn't everybody do that? No. And then they begin uncovering, oh, well, maybe that's part of my genius, because genius is easy. Genius is something that you love to do, and it also makes a contribution to others. And so the gateway to that is by richly appreciating. So whoever is appreciating, whether you're giving or receiving it, everybody gets to benefit.
All too true. I'm thinking of, in business, appreciation is a form of psychic income. And you know, I've seen it so many times in so many companies to which I've consulted. Psychic income costs you nothing. It costs a business nothing to say, you know, thanks for the effort, thanks for working late. I say again, it costs nothing. And the benefits can be extreme. Lesson number 10, everything can be resolved with love and willingness. Wait a minute, what, everything?
Yes, love is our most underrated healing tool, I think, because it was such a magnificent day in my life. The first time I realized many years ago, oh, there's a lot of me that I've just been criticizing all the time. Let me just love myself for once the way I am. Whew, that was a huge moment for me. And since I followed that up by writing a whole book called Learning to Love Yourself because of the power of that moment. And I get letters to this day, even though it's almost 50 years now since I wrote that book, that the act of learning to love yourself is one of the most transformative things people can do. We're not talking about egotism here. Egotism is an attempt to prove that you're lovable when you really don't feel lovable. And that's why it looks so tacky. But the actual genuine act of lovingly accepting yourself, that's so powerful. And then, of course, that leads to your ability to lovingly accept other people, which is the grand payoff for mm-hmm. it, because the extent to which you love yourself is the same extent to which you can love another person. The two interact mm-hmm. like that.
And so it's almost always something that you when I contract, when other people contract, it's because I'm afraid you're going to find out that there's something fundamentally unlovable about me. And so I try to hide it. But if I take a moment to love myself for feeling unlovable, because love can contain its opposite. So I can love myself for feeling critical. I can love myself for feeling that there's something fundamentally wrong with me. And the more, even if we say, just start with a drop of love, just give a drop of love somewhere where you'd be willing to receive it. And then that starts the opening and the expanding to be able to give and receive more love.
Okay. Let me ask one unscheduled question. This will be our, let me finish with this. We've been talking a lot about the things that you've learned in life. What have you unlearned lately? Something that you thought was true, used to think was true, but now realize it's just not the case at all.
Let me think about that for a moment. What have I unlearned recently? Oh man, I'm in a constant process of unlearning things.
Yeah, it's hard, you know, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, one thing I recently found myself kind of withdrawing from a relationship. And I think the reason I was doing it was based on a limiting belief of who that person really was. And so I let go of that to the best of my ability. And then things have shifted. You know, I feel differently about the relationship now. And so I think that would be an example of something I unlearn. And I kind of do that on a fairly regular basis. Mm-hmm. I think I like to catch myself in a limiting belief of some form.
I would say one of the most important things that I've unlearned is that I thought I could make everything better. If I just kept, you know, trying to understand and trying to listen and do it, that I could fix somebody else. And so my own commitment to fixing, Gay used to listen to fix. I used to organize my whole life around fixing, you know. And when I really let go of, oh, it's not possible for me to fix others. That was a big unlearning. They can step into making their choices, but I can't do that for them.
And even though you make a contribution to that effect.
Sure.
I make a contribution. It's like I set the table, but they have to kind of pick up the utensils.
And eat. Yeah, okay.
And eat, yes. Yeah, not okay. Just pick up and throw the utensils at people.
Okay, well, we will finish formally and officially on that note. You've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guests today have been Katie and Gay Hendricks of the Hendricks Institute. You can learn more about their events, their seminars, their numerous books, everything on Hendricks.com. Katie, you also mentioned the chair, the Foundation for Conscious Living.com.
Yes. It's a .org.
.org. Okay, that's charitable.
Yes, but you can get to it from .com. We have both of them covered, so people can find it. Yeah. Okay. And there are lots and lots of resources, and you'd be so welcome. We have also free classes that our coaches offer. So there are lots of resources for people to make use of.
And so our listeners have been listening to us, but we'd like to hear from you. You can email us. If you want to know anything about Gay and Katie's books or seminars, you contact me. The email address is podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. And I will get you the book. I will get you the information. Anything you want, we'll do it. This episode has been produced by Robert Hosry and is sponsored, as always, by the Professional Development Forum PDF. professionaldevelopmentforum.org. They supply seminars, webinars for young rising leaders. They do podcasts, parties, anything you want, everything you need. It's all there at professionaldevelopmentforum.org. And while you're at the email, go ahead and hit the subscribe button so that you don't miss any episodes of our continued conversations with leaders and luminaries. And do remember, this is the only podcast on the internet that makes the world a wiser place, lesson by lesson. Thank you for listening.